Did you ever get any chatter that he was still alive, you know, anywhere?
Well, we looked for him. I had information he was actually had fled to Oranje Pertet, which is a town on the Cambodian border with in Thailand. And so I actually wanted investigative assistance, and I went up there and spent a couple of days at a picture of Sukri and checked out all the bars and massage parlors and whatever, see if we could find him. And we never did. But the other case I was going to mention, I think you might find interesting, is while I was doing this undercover thing with Sukri, the agent who was handling the Herman Jackson, Ike Atkinson case in Bangkok, which is a group of retired military NCOs that had been smuggling heroin back to the States. That agent was transferred back to the States, and in those days, every case had to have an agent assigned to it, if only to write status reports. So my boss, Paul Brown, dumped this Atkinson case on me, and I thought, oh man, what? I got enough to do. But it actually turned out to be a blessing, because I guess after a few days, got a call from San Francisco from an agent, Lionel Stewart. And there had been a couple of guys arrested in Japan, military, U.S. Army guys. And they, one of them flipped and identified his source of supply as the bartender at a bar owned in Bangkok by this Herman Jackson. So I thought, wow, you know, maybe we can make something of this case after all. Long story short, Lionel came over and we made he actually made an undercover purchase of heroin from the source supply. We got him to San Francisco where he was arrested, and he ended up, it's a long story, but, we ended up being able to prosecute with some of the evidence we got through that case. We were able to prosecute Atkinson in North Carolina.
And you got to understand, Morgan, this guy he's talking about, Lionel Stewart. So when I get to Miami and Charles here is the ASAC, we had two associate SACs, and one of them was Lionel Stewart. This guy was a shucking and jiving character. I mean, he was hilarious, black gentleman, would not cut anybody slack. He, you know, he called a spade, and he did it to your face. He didn't do it behind your back. But he was hilarious. I mean, he would just entertain. You could see how the guy could work undercover. I mean, he could sell ice to an Eskimo, you know, that kind of attitude.
Yeah. Well, in my book, I call him the professor of undercover science.
There you go. That's a good title.
Okay. I'm not going to. Anyway, I just had a random thought, but I'm going to just hold on to that for now. But during that time that you were going, you know, you're moving up, you're working these cases. Tell us a little bit too about the history of the way things changed, because like you said, you started off working heroin and then you started getting cocaine, right? So over your time as you're seeing this and you're seeing all these drugs come out, do you always apply kind of the same approach and the same tactics, or do the different drugs require different strategies in terms of how to take them down and how to you find the source of supply and how to go after it?
I think it was fundamentally the same. However, the cocaine problem in America kind of I think it took everybody by surprise, and it was my role in it. I ended up in Miami Murph said, as an assistant in charge. And shortly after, I guess within a year, a position had opened up in charge of Caribbean interdiction operations and managing the offices that we had in the Caribbean, the Bahamas, of course, Jamaica, Dominican Republic. And so because of my military experience, by then the U.S. military, Department of Defense, had been brought in by President Reagan into the drug interdiction arena. So it was very important that we be able to coordinate DEAs, particularly our controlled deliveries out of Colombia with the military, because obviously the military is out there to interdict these smuggler aircraft, some of which could be our informants. And it would not only jeopardize a case, but could jeopardize the life of our CIs. And so because of my military experience, my overseas experience, I was given that job, which I have to say is probably the best job in DEA. And I did that for 3 years. My point is that for my first year, I had four groups in Miami, and they were doing traditional type investigations. But then most of my time in Miami was in the Caribbean, and it was really more interdiction than anything else.
So, you know, one of our previous episodes, Charles, we had a guy named Luis Navia. Does that name ring a bell?
It does not.
Murph, do you remember who worked that case?
It was...
Wasn't that a customs case originally?
It was, but the agent was out of Tampa.
Well, he'll figure it out.
Let me look here on our list.
Well, it was so funny. This guy was one of the guys kidnapped by Rascuño, not once, I think, but twice. And but he was talking about... They were delivering so much coke to Miami during that time. There was one lighthouse down there that was basically the target. They would fly in and just dump their loads because the lighthouse was basically the target they would aim at. And that's when you kind of what you're getting to is like, it was just became the Wild West, right? It became the new Wild West, the free for all down in Miami with all of this coke going on.
Mm-hmm. And you may remember Charles Eric Kolbinski.
Yeah, I know the name, yeah.
Yeah, so Eric's the one that actually went and invited Mr. Navia to come to the United States with me, young man.
After what was that coming out? I always get it wrong. It was Venezuela, right? He was coming out of Venezuela.
Right.
What did he have? 25? He had 25 tons of coke on a freighter.
25 tons of coke, yeah.
But back to you now. Back to our regularly scheduled podcast with you. So, you were talking about working. It's funny, though, you should mention the military. That's one thing I wanted to clear up for people. It's okay for the military to do international work outside the borders, but they cannot provide that same kind of assistance inside the borders because of Posse Comitatus. So a lot of the things you were able to do outside the U.S. were things you could not do right inside the U.S.
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, one of our principal operations in the Caribbean was in the Bahamas, Operation Bat. And we actually had U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopters and U.S. Coast Guard helicopters flying teams of Bahamian law enforcement and DEA advisors to the sites of offloads. And I can tell you, during the 3 years that I managed that program from Miami, the guys – John Pulley and Pat Shea. Pat Shea, the People magazine called him the Batman. They seized over 165 tons of cocaine and over 1,000 tons of marijuana during just the 3 years that I managed that program.
It was a nice thing. I did that for 3 months in 1989 after Kevin Stevens was shot, my partner. And went down there, and they had done such a good job. And Pat was still stationed in Nassau at the time. They had done such a good job that I saw cocaine one time in 3 months while we were there. And that was a bell had washed up on the eastern shore of Grand Bahama Island, which is all uninhabited out there. 72 kilos inside that bell.
Well, what you missed was at one point, I actually got permission from headquarters to teach them scuba diving.
Nice.
So that our agents could go down to sunken vessels, aircraft, and retrieve the drugs with coke or marijuana before the locals did.
Yeah, and you know, I even saw photographs later on. They taught the agents how to be extracted from a helicopter hanging onto that rope where they're attached to the rope.
That zip line, yeah. Yeah,
and it just pulls everybody up in the air and away they go. I've seen photographs of that, some of the agents I knew.
Well, we had some guys go through I went through the 2-week DEA school, but some of the guys went through the advanced stuff where they would do the marijuana eradication. They would infill them and exfill them, you know, using the Blackhawks and on that zip line. And apparently there is a kind of tradition, let's say, for the guy who's the biggest prick in the class, he's the last one on the zip line. So when they're like going across the water, they dunk his ass in the water a few times in that Blackhawk before they. Oh, that was so much fun back then.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Op Bat was so successful that it actually began to discourage the Colombians from using that route to bring drugs into the United States. They love the Bahamians. The Bahamians are very nice, nonviolent people. You know, the few that were involved in this were just in it for the money. The Colombians loved it. And of course, it's the most direct route from Colombia, the shortest route into the United States. But Op Bat put up so many obstacles to them that they started looking elsewhere. At one point, we found cocaine seizures aboard vessels on the Miami River from Haiti. The cocaine being seized from them began to spike. And I got permission basically to open an office in Port-au-Prince. So I spent quite a bit of time down there establishing that office. Walter Brown and Juan Rodriguez ran the office there, and they did the first drug seizure probably ever in terms of undercover operations. They did. I mean, I enjoyed going there, believe it or not.
So did Murph. Didn't you have a week down there where you got the shits?
Let me tell you what, if the world has a butthole, it's called Haiti.
It's actually, if you go up country, I mean, Port-au-Prince is squalor, but
yeah.
If you go up country, there's some beautiful parts of Haiti, and I just enjoy going. It was a challenge.
Yeah. Oh, it was a challenge.
But anyway, I brought an Op Bat team down there to basically open the office, and I asked the Coast Guard to put a ship down at the southern end of Haiti. We never seized anything. I guess the word had gotten out that DEA was there, and so the Coast Guard, they had one of their H-3 helicopters stationed at Port-au-Prince, and started taking. It was like Disney World. I guess it'd be Disney World East, taking the Haitians police, some of whom had never been up in a helicopter, had never seen their country before, and took them up for rides. But the word in Colombia that we got through some of our informants was that the cartels were saying, don't go to Haiti. DEA is everywhere. I mean, we had two guys there.
There you go. It only takes two to do the war on drugs. Take down Pablo, take down the Cali cartel. Hey, before we talk about something, I want to get into talking about Operation Snowcap. You brought up something. I was thinking about this, and all of a sudden it crystallized. Do you think because of your success on things like Op Bat and other things like that, that denied the shipping lanes? Because now if you look at it, it's kind of the dynamics have changed. The cartels in Mexico kind of run everything, right? So now you've got the land transport. Do you think some of that is what shifted the kind of the power base and shifted the transportation routes to coming through Mexico because of your success over there in the Caribbean?
I know it did. I mean, I think you can follow the history of it, and you can see that, and particularly once we shut them out of Haiti, they really had nowhere else to go in the Caribbean. So they did. They were very reluctant, I think, to establish an alliance with the Mexicans, because the Mexicans, unlike the Bahamians, can be very violent. And demanding, and they wanted a piece of the action. But I think because of Operation Op Bat and other things that were being done in the Caribbean, that the Mexicans didn't have an alternative. And of course, it's an alliance between the Colombians and Mexicans that's plaguing us to this day.
You know, and it's nowhere close to what it used to be coming through the Caribbean corridor there. But, you know, you talk to agents that are still on the job that work in that area, and the Dominican Republic is still a pretty hot place. It's probably the hottest place within all the Caribbean islands now. But just like Charles said, Mexico's that's the main thrust of cocaine coming to the United States.
Well, they've kind of stuck it to the Colombians too, because now the only way to get through it basically is you got to go through their plazas, through their, you know, bosses, mm-hmm. through their, you know, areas. Hey, let's talk about Operation Snowcap, because we've had a couple folks on that did their time in Operation Snowcap. I don't remember, did Zach do time on Snowcap?
I don't think so. I don't remember him saying that.
Yeah. So let us all of our players out there, tell us what Operation Snowcap was and why that was such an important operation.
Well, I have to say that this was another example of my military experience, which included by then my Caribbean, you know, interdiction operations with the Navy and Army, that got me transferred out of my favorite job, the best job in DEA. Kicking and screaming, I was dragged up to Washington to take over the Snowcap program, which had begun a few years before. There was an Operation Blast Furnace in Bolivia. For the first time, agents were sent as advisors with host nation law enforcement to raid cocaine base laboratories in Bolivia. It had a tremendous impact, and DEA wanted to sustain that. So they created this Operation Snowcap. They convinced the State Department to get, at that time, initially, like a dozen countries in South America to allow DEA agents to accompany their law enforcement people in going after these labs. Well, by 1990, it had shrunk, the operation had shrunk down to the two key countries of Bolivia and Peru. And so I was a skeptic of Snowcap. A lot of managers didn't like it because it drew manpower away from them. From their offices, but I just thought, you know, it's a paramilitary operation kind of far afield from what DEA's expertise is and what we should be doing, basically investigations. However, once I got up there, I made a trip down to South America. I went to Bolivia, to Peru, and over time, I became a believer. there were two problems. One, of course, was the manpower drain. But what people lost sight of was that when Snowcap began, Congress gave DEA 277 positions to compensate them for the agents that would be sent down, trained, and deployed in Snowcap. Well, the reality of it is there were never 277 agents in the program during its entire life. And during my tenure, I had it for 4 years, the longest serving director of that operation. During my time, we never had more than 35 agents deployed downrange at any one time. So that was ridiculous. The problem was a lot of those positions didn't necessarily go to the SACs that were supporting the program with manpower. So they had a beef, but it wasn't with Snowcap. The other problem, as I mentioned, was the nature of the operation. For one thing, my predecessor had kind of run it out of Washington, out of headquarters, and I didn't think that was appropriate. I think the country attachés need to run their programs, whether it's their investigations or operations like Snowcap. They should be the people responsible and in charge. much to my relief, they came up with this kingpin strategy where going after the cartels in Colombia, they would go after their infrastructure, the people who financed it, who smuggled it, brought the money back. I mean, all the infrastructure of these organizations, go after it all. And I made the argument that Snowcap was part of that strategy to go after their source of cocaine base, which they needed to make their cocaine hydrochloride. I don't know that Bobby Nieves, who was kind of the Snowcap guru, I don't know that he ever bought into that. But it was enough to convince the senior leadership in DEA that we, in fact, were part of the kingpin strategy.
Well, obviously, you know, the cocaine paste that's coming out of Bolivia and Peru into Colombia results in hydrochloride, which is owned by all the cartels, and then comes to the United States. That's a pretty easy connection to make there. You're muted, Morgan.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Well, finally, you got your mute button that you needed there, Murph.
Yeah, I need an extension of that button right here on my desk.
Hey, but that was one of the things Michelle Linhart told us about. One of the big cases she made was, I think, on the largest paste producer. I think it was down in Bolivia, maybe. But yeah, that was one of her big cases. It was, yeah.
So I thought Snowcap was a very important program. I think it had a significant impact on the cocaine trade in those days. It ended tragically. Jack Lawn, our administrator, started it and got the support of the State Department and the Department of Defense that loved it. But then Rob Bonner came in as the administrator, he adopted it. He allowed me to expand it into Central America, into Guatemala, Operation Cadence, which was extremely successful. It's a great example of just how effective these operations can be. But then we had Administrator Constantine come in. Janet Reno is the Attorney General, and they were opposed to it. They just had a different philosophy about overseas operations. I respect their point of view. They didn't think agents should be risking their lives in other countries, that it was the foreign country's responsibility to solve their own problem. I could understand that, but I thought it was very naive because we're the ones that are creating the problem for them. You know, it's easy for us to point the finger, say those rotten Colombians and Mexicans and Bolivians are causing this problem. They're not causing a problem. They're simply trying to satisfy us, our demand for illegal substances, which is a disgrace. And we're the ones causing them a problem that is corrupting their governments. And then we go down to try and help them to help us to stop this madness. And there are people like, you know, like Tom Constantine who just would not agree.
Who didn't, you know, rest in peace, Constantine, but did not see the big picture and did not have any overseas experience.
You're being diplomatic too, because I got to tell you, we've had some other DEA folks on that were less diplomatic than you talking about him. I believe he was a New York City cop, right?
No, he was state police.
State police, yeah. State police. And to your point, you can't, it's one of the lessons we learned out of Vietnam, right? You can't micromanage the war from the Pentagon. You know, you got to put people on the ground. They have to, and to your point, when you took over Snowcap, you have to be in country. People with the best knowledge are the boots on the ground, the people that are tip of the spear, right? So I always thought it was short-sighted when you try and do stuff and you don't go out and you don't visit, you don't know what's out there, you don't know who's doing what. You can't be an effective leader, you know, of this stuff. And so, again, you're being charitable and diplomatic. Appreciate that in keeping with your stature as a elder statesman on this call. But it was short-sighted. I mean, I think it set us back. In several of these things, it set us back. You make so many gains. it takes years to make those games, but it only takes days to lose it.
I don't mind being called a statesman, but an elder statesman?
I only said on this call.
Okay.
Hey, Charles, that's why I invited you on here, because usually I'm the oldest guy on the screen here.
Yeah, I've got 911 on speed dial in case Murph vapor locks on me during the interview and stuff, you know.
911 Orlando.
But just to close out on Snowcap, of course, it ending it was no easy thing for Tom Constantine, because the State Department loved it. The Department of Defense envied it. You know, they provided all the support we needed. They even gave me a staff of officers to help coordinate their support of us. So it was very difficult to justify shutting down this program. And unfortunately, actually, after I left the program, it was probably 2 months after I left the program, I'd been running that. I was reluctant to leave, to be honest, because I had really a lot of admiration for the people in that program. But I was at it for 4 years, longer than I had ever had any job in my entire career. And I thought if I was going to have any career left, it was time to leave. So I left. I actually took a job as the deputy director of foreign operations. So when I was in that job after a couple of months, we had that tragic plane crash in Peru, and we lost some wonderful agents. One of them I had actually encouraged to get into the Snowcap program, Meredith Thompson, so it kind of struck home to me. And, you know, you're speaking about my graciousness toward Tom Constantine. He was gracious to me. He actually sent me down. He originally sent the new director of foreign operations, Jim Milford, down, and Donnie Marshall, head of the air wing. And then the next day, realizing how touched I was and hurt by this, he sent me down. He didn't need to do that. So I went down there. By the time I got there, they had found the crash and actually had extracted the bodies from the plane in a truly heroic effort. And then Jim Milford and I escorted the bodies back to Washington to their families and Tom Constantine and Janet Reno were there, you know, to officiate that reception. So anyway, it was a tragic ending. That's what actually, I mean, I guess they figured no one could really blame DEA for ending it after that. But it was actually, you know, the program was reconstituted years later. One of my team leaders was Mike Braun, who rose up long after I was gone to be the chief of operations. And in Afghanistan, he began the FAST program, which actually was Snowcap in Afghanistan.
And that's, we haven't done this in a while, Morgan. Let's dedicate today's episode to the agents killed in Peru. And that was in addition to Meredith Thompson, who was a close friend of mine down there. We were young agents together, different groups, but also special agents, Frank Wallace, Jay Seal, Juan Vars, and Frank Fernandez. God bless you. Rest in peace. You represented your country well. In my book, that makes you a patriot.
Well, thank you for doing that, Murph. And I have to say, just as a interesting note, Frank Fernandez was the supervisor, the team leader down there in Peru at that time. And months before I left Snowcap, the movie film crew from Clear and Present Danger,
Tom Clancy novel,
the movie based on that.
Harrison Ford played Jack Ryan.
Exactly. Well, they came to DEA headquarters to be briefed on how these laboratory raids actually occurred. So, of course, I was asked by Constantine to brief them, and which I did. And by the way, in the book, there's not even a mention of DEA. But I told the film crew how it really worked and who really did that type of work. And there is in the movie actually a female DEA agent in charge of the office there in Colombia. But in any event, Frank was back from a tour of down south at the time. So we were doing what we called a mount out, which is it's a preparation of a team, kind of a team building we did at Quantico in advance of a team being deployed down to Bolivia and Peru. So they would go through, firearms and different types. And so I called Frank and I said, hey, I want you to take this film crew down to Quantico so they can actually see the real deal, how it really works and who's doing it. So Frank, being the guy that he was, one of the young ladies on the film crew, he began dating, and she got him into the last scene. And by chance, the last scene in the movie, by chance, my wife and I were invited to go to the filming of it. We got to meet Harrison Ford in his high heels. He's very short. So he wears wears these high heels to elevate him. But in any event, Frank Fernandez is sitting. When Harrison Ford walks into the Congress to spill the beans on what the military had been doing, if you look at the top row behind the congressman, there's staffers, and the second from the left is Frankie Fernandez.
How about that?
So I think that's kind of cool. And I have to say, and last thing about Constantine, that I have to say, and I had some problems later in my career with him, but at that time he took me with him to each of the funerals of the three agents, and I will always be grateful for that.
Well, we're not trying to cast aspersions on him. I'm just saying that, like you say, years ago, but I think one of the reasons he did that too, even being state police, being a cop, going to a funeral is a big deal. That is your final measure of respect. And so, we salute him for doing that. I wanted to ask you, though, just from an emotional standpoint, just from an investigative standpoint, what did they determine to be the cause of the crash?
The agents, and of course, we'll never know exactly, but what I believed happened was they had some information that there was a cocaine-based lab of some sort along this riverbank. You need water for the process. And so they were doing a milk run from our base camp at Santa Lucia to Pucallpa, where we had a rest and recuperation place. And so they said, hey, on our way, let's see if we can find this lab, spot it, and then we can send people in later, to take it down. Apparently, when they flew in, they flew up this creek and didn't realize that it was a box canyon. And I think what happened is they tried to pull up. It was a CASA short takeoff and landing aircraft. They're not made to go straight up in the air. And it flipped over and went nose down into the jungle, and basically on the top of a mountain. And the difficulty in getting to it was that it was difficult to get a helicopter rotor close enough because of the slope of the hill to get it close enough to be able to land anybody. The helicopters couldn't land. Actually, the group led by Frank Balazs, a former snowcap team leader who by then was a group supervisor in Lima, he took a team there, and actually they were fast roped down from a helicopter, which is an amazingly brave act. And then they spent time, they spent an overnight extracting the bodies from the aircraft and cutting down trees so a helicopter could land the next day to take the bodies and them out. It was an amazing feat.
Yeah. The lengths you'll go to take care of your own.
Well, and that had to be emotionally tough too, flying back. You know, it's almost like when they bring the service people over, the service members over, they land at Dover. What was that like, you know, for you?
It was heartbreaking for me, and I still, you know, think about it. I'll tell you, they had the first, we have a DEA survivor benefit fund that retired agents pay into, you know, and they have fundraisers, golf tournaments all around the country to raise money that goes to the, basically to the children of our slain agents. Kiki Camarena's one son I know is a judge today, paid for by the Survivor Benefit Fund. So it's a wonderful thing. In any event, they had the very first Meredith Thompson golf tournament in Washington, D.C. the year after the crash. And I was paired up with Meredith Thompson's father. He could not have been more gracious.
Yeah. You know, before I left D.C. a couple years ago, excuse me, I would still go out to the Meredith Thompson's golf benefit. And I'm not a golfer, but, you know, go out and support and, you know, carry food, carry chairs, ride around in a golf cart, smoke cigars and all the fun stuff that you get to do out there. And his sister, or Meredith's sister, still supports that. And her mom still comes down to that every year.
Wow.
Or comes up to it, I guess, from South Carolina.
Man. Well, let's kind of move to things, lighten things up here a little bit. You had a long career in DEA, because I mean, we want to be respectful of time. We're kind of getting in on that, but I wanted to talk about your takeaway from DEA, because you didn't stop serving. So, what made you finally decide that I've done my time? Was it just mandatory retirement age? Did you extend, or you know, what was your decision?
I actually had taken a job. Detailed it within the Department of Justice to set up a new organization to try to improve the coordination, cooperation, information exchange among federal law enforcement agencies, the intelligence community, and with state and local police. It's something that I was at it for about a year and a half before I retired. And it's something that after 9/11, I thought, geez, they should have had the same type of organization to coordinate intelligence information on terrorism. And it might have helped to prevent that tragedy. But in any event, I was within a year of retirement, mandatory, when 9/11 hit. And in a record 29 days from that tragedy, George Bush signed into law the Transportation Security Act, which created the Transportation Security Administration. Under federal law, you can't take another federal position unless your salary is reduced by the amount of your retirement annuity. So for me to become a TSA employee, basically, I'd be working for nothing. I would have done almost anything after 9/11 to get even with Osama bin Laden, but working for nothing was not one of them. So shortly thereafter, Congress passed some legislation which allowed up to 5 years to be exempted from that requirement. And when I heard that, I said, wow, I was the first in line. And in fact, I was the first DEA person to be hired by the new TSA.
Why did you pick TSA? What was it about it that said, I want to go do that? I mean, obviously, you know, we get the 9/11 reference. In fact, on our episode that came out on 9/11, we had a former CIA case officer, Rick Prieto, was on, and we were talking a lot about that. But what made you want to, you were leaving DEA, like you said, approaching retirement age. What made you say TSA is the place I want to go?
Well, it was just 9/11. Just in the aftermath of that, I thought whatever I can do to help is what I want to do. And of course, with my background, I've never worked in an airport before, to be honest.
But, you flew through a hell of a lot of them, right?
Yeah. but my, you know, my law enforcement, you know, actually people don't understand this, but TSA was created as a law enforcement agency. And what had happened was, in the law, if you look at the original bill, the FBI was required to give up its responsibility for investigating security incidents at airports. State and local police were to give up their responsibility at airports to a uniformed TSA force. Well, neither of them were happy about that. And they lobbied Congress. And within months, Congress retracted that, and the FBI kept their investigative responsibility. I was supposed to have had I was hired to go to Orlando, Florida airport, which at that time was the fifth largest in terms of number of screeners. I was supposed to have a uniformed police force, a handful of investigators. I got none of that. They should have changed the name from Transportation Security Administration to Transportation Screening Administration, because that's what we ended up doing. I did have one law enforcement assistant. In fact, I lured Rick Scovel away from DEA. He was the agent in charge of the Orlando office for DEA. So I don't know, DEA hopefully has forgotten that by now, but Rick was terrific. And what his job was to ensure that there was an appropriate response to security incidents by federal, state or local police, and to investigate allegations against our own screeners, our own employees. But, anyway, so I had taken a job thinking I was getting into a law enforcement organization. By the time I got to Orlando, however, things had changed dramatically.
Well, yeah, boy, had they. Because that's actually what I was getting back to. We were talking, when you started there, what year was it when you started TSA? Just right after 9/11?
Well, it was 2002. I mean, obviously, it took... You know, the hiring process took several months, and I actually started in April of 2002. So I retired from DEA on a Friday.
And started Monday?
Monday, and believe me, I had 1,000 screeners in Orlando. That was not a retirement job.
Now, were you living in Orlando at the time, or did you have to move there?
I was in Washington, D.C., and... You know, I had been, as we talked about, in Miami for 4 years and enjoyed it, but we had no intention of ever going back. We were in Washington, D.C. We were in the home that we had built in 1978 and moved back into four times.
Where was that at?
In Oakton, Virginia.
Yeah, I'm still Murph, the traitorous bastard, left me a couple years ago. I'm in Ashburn, so.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I'm at it's actually Stuart Mill Woods. It's near Fox Mill Road in Oakton. And anyway, I forget where I was going.
No, you were talking about you'd move back and forth. You weren't ever going to move back to Florida again.
To Florida. But, you know, when they offered me Orlando, you know, Joy and I talked about it. I said, you know, it's hard for me to say I'll only go where I want to go. In the aftermath of 9/11. And Joy agreed. She said, hey, if that's where they want you to go, let's go. So back to Florida we went.
Hey, real quickly, by the time you moved back to Florida, how many different places had you lived by that time, you think, by the time you ended up back in Orlando?
Well, in my career, and I had a couple since then, but in my career, I moved 14 times.
Now, did your kids ever get lost on the way home, or how about you? You know,
they never really knew where to call home. But I have to say, and I felt bad about that often, moving him around. For example, when I got drafted, the only move that I didn't ever actually ask for was the one to Snowcap out of Miami. I mean, I had the dream job and left there. But to make matters even worse, my older daughter was a rising senior in high school. And, you know, our daughters were teenagers and they had all their friends there in the Miami area. And I had to drag them up there. So it was painful at times. But years later, they have told me that their experiences helped them to grow and that they would never trade anywhere that they've lived and what they've done for anything. So that makes you feel good.
Yeah, it helps alleviate that guilt feeling a little bit, doesn't it?
It does. It helps.
I think we all go through that. There's one other thing, and I don't want to cut you short on TSA, but I know at the end of the book, you have a personal mission that you've gone on to revive, like the father of DEA, the godfather of DEA, one of the original creators here, a guy named Harry Anslinger, and I don't want us to run out of time before you get a chance to mention that. So again, and I'm sorry, we're running out of time, but I want to give you the opportunity here to tell us quickly about Harry and what you're trying to do.
Well, this was some years after I retired from full-time employment. And, you know, I was doing part-time work, but it had always bothered me that, as you say, the father of international drug law enforcement was a forgotten man, not only by the general public, but even within DEA, there was no mention of him, no memorial, no picture, no plaque, no building named for him, nothing, save for perhaps some memorabilia in the DEA museum. And I thought that was terrible. So it all started. I've been a mentor of criminal justice students up at Penn State for probably 30 years now. And so every year that I was in the area, we'd go to a ceremony with some of the students, and the FBI would present an award, $500 or something, to one of the undergraduate students. Well, to the student, to the families, to the staff, they thought the FBI was terrific. And guess what? They named it the J. Edgar Hoover Award. As many warts as that guy has.
That's a good way to put it.
So I proposed to DEA, retired, it was actually the FBI Retired Agents Association. So I proposed to the DEA Retired Agents Association that they start their own scholarship award modestly. They decided they were instead going to keep the money going to the Survivors Benefit Fund, understandably so. But then DEA was running a series of programs out of the museum, and I suggested that we should have Harry Anslinger as one, you know, as a topic of one of these programs, and so they agreed to do that. I got the fellow who wrote the book, the definitive biography of Anslinger, to be the keynote speaker. I spoke. So in preparation for that, I read just about everything that I could find about Anslinger, things that he had written. And probably a month before, I saw on the internet that the guy was being accused of being a racist. And I thought, wow, if this guy was a racist, I don't want to be promoting this guy, you know? And so I started getting nervous about it. And I got to do some research anyway. I learned that Anslinger had hired the first black agents of any federal agency, at least federal law enforcement agency. And I actually found one of them, Bill Davis. He was living in Potomac, Maryland. I flew up and went to his house and spoke with him about it. And he said, he told me, he said, yeah, he said, there were racists in the FBN, Federal Bureau of Narcotics, predecessor to BNDD and DEA. He said, but Harry Anslinger wasn't one of them. Well, this guy, is it Wayne Valentine? He wrote a book. I don't know. I have it here. It's Strength of a Wolf or something like that. That says that Bill Davis quit DEA because he couldn't get promoted. And I asked Bill, and he said, well, no, that's not what really happened. He said, I decided to quit because apparently he, at that time, he had to pass the Federal Service Entrance Exam. He was unable to do that or hadn't taken it. And he was hired under Schedule A, which doesn't allow you to be promoted beyond journeyman level until you pass the FSEE. So he decided he was going to go with State Department. He spoke five languages. He was going to go with the State Department, and which he did. When Anslinger learned about it, he called Bill Davis from Baltimore to his office in Washington. He said, Bill, why are you leaving? And Davis told me, he said, because I want to be a diplomat like you. Well, I asked him about the chapter in one of Anslinger's books that talks about Bill Davis working undercover against an Italian organized crime group, the 107th Street Gang. And Anslinger had made a hero out of him. Well, Bill Davis didn't even know the book had been written, let alone anything about him. So and that's not something that a racist is going to do. And so I sent a copy after I got home. I sent a copy of the book to Bill, so he would see that. But in any event, I was convinced he was not a racist. In fact, Bill Davis came to the program at DEA headquarters about Anslinger, along with 17 of Anslinger's family, who were just amazed that DEA was finally recognizing their beloved ancestor. Anyway, so I feel real good about that.
You know, and that just shows you that politics and misinformation can skew the best reputations of anybody. It doesn't matter who they are. It just kills you. You know, this guy, he's a hero for back in his time. And I, some of the things you talk about in your book that he implemented and he did, they're just groundbreaking.
Well, he's the one who convinced J. Edgar Hoover that there was such a thing as Italian organized crime. Hoover would not admit it. And it was Anslinger, was a diplomat. He was a representative in the United Nations. They kept him there 7 years after he retired because he was considered the world's expert on international drug control. He's responsible for the single convention upon which our drug law is based, and probably 90% of every drug law in the world. I mean, the guy was incredible. And again, everybody knows who J. Edgar Hoover is. Nobody remembered Harry Anslinger.
Not even in our own organization.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, and the things they remember J. Edgar Hoover for aren't always flattering either. So, but I want to ask you something about that, though. I am so sick of the cancel culture where merely the accusation is enough is to derail stuff. True, there are things, but you know, people forget so many things. For example, Frank Sinatra refused to, I think, play at one of the Las Vegas hotels because they wouldn't let Sammy Davis in. And he says, if he can't get in, I'm not doing anything. There are so many examples of people through history who are not racist. And I'm glad you brought that up because I just think it's disingenuous for one person to be able to say, well, he's a racist, we can't do that. And I'd like to turn it back around. Well, where's your proof? Here's all the other stuff. Where's your proof? It can't be that the accusation is simply enough anymore. If that was the case, then why have a trial? Why have a defense attorney? We simply, if I accuse you of the crime, you're guilty of the crime, let's just go straight to sentencing. That would never fly in American justice.
Well, Harry Anslinger, after he retired, He retired in Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania. The mayor of the town presented him. They actually had a Harry Anslinger day, presented him with a plaque, and said that the plaque would hang in the Blair County Courthouse in perpetuity. So as part of my research, I went there, and it was gone. No plaque. Nobody. In fact, the county commissioners there had never, they themselves had never heard of Harry Anslinger. So I got AFNA to fund the recreate. I found in an old newspaper the actual wording of the original plaque. I had it reproduced, and I got the current commissioners in Blair County, the mayor of Hollidaysburg, to ceremonially restore the plaque back on the wall. And I have a friend, one of my mentoring buddies from Penn State, who's an attorney. His office right across the street, by chance, in a building that used to be a coffee shop that Anslinger used to hang out with his buddies after retirement. And I got him watching to make sure the plaque is never taken down again.
Well, those four bolts and Gorilla Glue and the plastic cover over it. Yeah, you know. And the
hey, one thing we need to add on there is we have a rule here that if you use an acronym, you got to tell what it is. So you mentioned AFNA.
That's the Association of Former Narcotics Agents.
There you go.
Which is so we were DEA's at conference. Retirement age. Murph and I were just at a conference in Nashville.
Yeah.
They have an annual conference. And
first time we've seen each other since, I don't know, maybe since Miami days.
Yeah. You know, in Miami, I was going to say that you started out talking about you were a new agent in Miami when I was brought there as an ASAC. I'd like to be able to say that you stood out.
Here comes the backhanded compliment,
but Murph, I'm sorry, I don't remember you.
You don't remember the redneck undercover that went to Turks and Caicos on his first big trip and everybody got sick except him.
But Murph did quite well for himself throughout his career, no question about that.
See, I was going to give you credit for that, Charles, but not now.
But, you know, but hey, but let's look at it in a positive light. If you were a real fuck up, a real screw up, he would have remembered who you were.
That's very true. That's right. That's the thing in DEA. We remember the worst about people, not the best.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it is with a lot of cops. Well, hey, look, Charles, I mean, there's so many stories I know we could go into, but I want to be respectful of your time. But look, we don't want to end before we say a couple of things. Number one is we give you credit for TSA. You got to tell everybody what you're credited for with TSA in Orlando. In other words, being the first to do something. What was that down in Orlando?
Well, we were the first airport, major airport, to actually complete a federal takeover of screening. We were considered, mentioned by Condé Nast Traveler as the most friendly, family-friendly airport in the nation. So, I mean, we got a lot of credit, but the credit is not due to me as much as it is the fellas and ladies who work for me down there in TSA that worked literally day and night trying to do almost an impossible job. You know, TSA is the largest bureaucracy organization created since World War II. Literally overnight, an agency of almost 50,000 people were created. And people don't understand that the original bill creating TSA established certain basic requirements for screeners. I was told I would be inheriting 1,000 screeners from 911 and giving them better supervision and training. Only 10% could meet those basic requirements. We had to hire in Orlando alone 700 new screeners, some of whom had never been in an airport before, let alone did security screening in one. So it was a tremendous challenge, and it's something that I'm very proud of that we were able to accomplish.
Well, I just want to make one comment about that, that you're not taking the credit, which is a sign of a leader. However, when, as I moved up through the ranks and, you know, you're mentoring others to come up through the ranks and take promotions and take on more responsibilities and help younger agents to become better agents, they would come in and when their agents did something well, I credited them as the supervisor. And they said, it wasn't me, it was the agents. Well, you know what? The buck stops with you as the boss. So you do get the credit because you gave your people the opportunity. But here's the backside. When your agents screw up, you're going to step up and take the blame to protect them. That's what a leader does. So it's nice of you to be humble there, and we appreciate that. But the truth is here, Charles, you were a leader. You still are a leader amongst men. It's been a true honor to have you on here today, even though you don't freaking remember me. I thought we were like this, you know?
Murph, we are now.
Well, and there goes my chance to get any dirt on Murph back in Miami. Murph who? I don't remember that little. Hey, but Murph.
I love it. That's great.
Tell everybody about his book again, because you got it in front of you. So we want to make sure, and we'll put it on our book list too. So Charles, we have a book page. We're going to list it there. We're going to let everybody know where to get it.
Yeah, so the name of it is Unpopular Causes, A Career in Service to America. Charles Harry Lutz is the author. I got my copy off of Amazon. Do you have a website, Charles?
I do. It's unpopularcauses.com.
There you go. So
easy to remember.
Unpopular Causes. And that's, you know what? A lot of people think that that's what they think of law enforcement. So,
well, not only law enforcement, Vietnam, the most unpopular war in our history, TSA, the agency everyone loved to hate. Everything I did in my career, I think, was unpopular with somebody.
But also, we want to, and I mentioned this earlier, we want to give credit to your wonderful wife, Joy. I've never had the honor or pleasure of meeting her. But you outline the sacrifices that she makes in the book. And it's true of all of our wives. They give us the latitude to do our jobs, not knowing whether we're going to come home at night. We drag them away from whatever careers they might want to have, so that we can have our careers, and they're there to support us 100%. So, Joy, and if you hear this, Joy, my hat is off to you. I hope to meet you someday. You're as big a hero as your husband is in my eyes.
And when she meets you, Murph, she's going to go, never heard of you.
Probably. Well, see, we're used to that because people say, oh, Narcos. What was your role in Narcos? I said, you know who Pablo Escobar is? They say, sure. And I say, you know who Steve Murphy and Javier Pena are? Who?
It reminds me, last thing here. Do you remember the movie The Dirty Dozen? Remember the one thing where Donald Sutherland is going down and he's talking? They got him impersonating the general and he goes, where are you from? I think he said something like Ottumwa, Iowa. Never heard of it, son. Just deflated him. Just moved on.
Took the wind right out of his sails.
Well, hey, Charles, so this is us saluting you. First of all, welcome home, soldier. I take it personal, too, because my dad, like I said, World War II and Vietnam vet. So many people didn't get the welcome home they deserved. So on behalf of us, thank you for your service to our great country, not only in the Army, but in DEA, and as well as TSA, and we'll make sure people go to unpopularcauses.com. They'll get your book, Unpopular Causes. We'll put that on our book page. And this is us, sir, Lieutenant, Captain, whatever you retired as, General, saluting you, saying thank you. Been an honor to have you on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
All right. You guys don't go anywhere. Stand by. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. I'm sorry, who are you again?
I don't know. I thought I was well known, but Charles didn't even know me.
Never heard of you.
You know what? And I was just telling Morgan, Charles contacted me later that night after the interview and apologized on an email and said, I guess his wife ripped him a new one. Joy, love you, lady. I've never met you, but I love you. But I told Charles, that's one of the funniest things we've ever had happen on the podcast. I love it.
And here's the guy goes down. Well, here, but the good thing point, like I said, was if you were a real screw up, you know, they would have known your name. So.
That's exactly right.
That's like me. You go back and ask people about Morgan Wright. Him? Is he still around?
Well, you know, in DEA, we're infamous for not remembering the good things about people. We remember the bad things about people.
Well, this is an episode, guys. When you get done listening to this, you'll listen to the good things. So, hey, Charles, again, this is us. Welcome home, soldier.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your service to our country. Thank you for serving DEA and TSA. And again, we also want to remember the other thing we do is we dedicated it to the five agents killed in the plane crash.
Yes.
As part of Operation Snowcap down in Peru. And one of them happened to be a friend of yours.
Yeah, Meredith Thompson. We were baby agents together in Miami. So it's you just, you know, you never know what's going to happen in life.
Yeah, never know. Well, again, this is us saluting you. So, hey, guys, but if you like that, make sure you head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Hit those 5 stars if you like that episode. Tell us what you think about it. Also, head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com. That's where we put his book there, so it'll be on our book page, Unpopular Causes, and you can find it at his website, unpopularcauses.com. Some great pictures, some great anecdotes, and that's where you can order the book from. Also, follow us on that thing on social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Hey, but you know, you got to go over to Patreon, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. And Murph, I got to tell you right now, when we do our next episode of 911, What's Your Emergency? Mm-hmm. I have one of the most unique 911 calls ever made.
Oh, cool. Cool. We got to get that one recorded.
That's just going to be, we're not going to do a whole case about that. I have another one for that, but I came across this and I said, this is the most unique call I've ever heard in my life.
Wow. Looking forward to it.
You're going to have to listen if you want to find out. So remember, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We do that. We've got our Q&A session that comes up. We've got our case of the month that we talked about. We review movies, which Murph is not being allowed to pick another movie for 6 months as punishment.
I'm in timeout.
You're in timeout. You know, and you can't make this shit up. We just had some stuff like the story about the guy on the power wheels, the Jeep. You just can't make this shit up. No.
Seriously, come over and check us out on Patreon. If you think you're a crime sleuth, you know, and you've always
say wanted, that as a crime sleuth.
Yeah, that's when you've been drinking. You know, I had coffee. but seriously, come over because I know nothing about these crimes that Morgan's going to put up on the 911, and he starts it off by playing the 911 call, and that's how we begin trying to figure out what happened. So if you enjoy that kind of stuff, I mean, like right now as we're recording today, CrimeCon is taking place here in Orlando, and we completely missed that one. Shame on us. But that's where crime sleuths go. So, you know, come over and just take a look at Patreon and see what you think of it.
Yeah, and take a look and take a listen, because that's what we do on patreon.com/Game of Crimes. Okay, guys. Also, make sure you head on over to Game of Crimes fans. Type that into Facebook. Our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, rules with an iron fist and a velvet glove, will let you in if you are deemed worthy. But you know what? More importantly, we want to thank you guys for listening to us once again. Right? This, we can't do this without you. So we really appreciate your help on this. So support us through Apple and Spotify. Support us through sharing this with your friends, but support us mainly by allowing me to finish up by saying thank you once again for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all. And I have no idea who you are, Game of Crimes.
New messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.